From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, as measles continues to spread in Texas, will state leaders learn a lesson about the need for tougher vaccine requirements? And there's more evidence that the Texas abortion ban is making childbirth more dangerous, but the state doesn't want you to know that.
To understand what is happening in the state of Texas when the state of Texas doesn't want to give that information to its own residents.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. As of Friday morning, the Texas Department of State Health Services is reporting that the outbreak of measles in West Texas is now at 90 cases. 16 of the patients have been hospitalized. This is one of the worst measles outbreaks in the nation in decades, and additional cases are likely to occur in the outbreak area. There are measles cases in 7 different counties now, including the higher population areas of Lubbock and Odessa. Terry Burke is the executive director of the Texas-based Immunization Partnership.
Sadly, I feel like that's just the tip of the iceberg. We have talked to public health directors in that region. We have talked to physicians. Everyone is now saying that it's going to go into the hundreds. They are testing. I mean, one health director told us that a week ago he tested 50 exposures. I mean, that's not to say that they have measles, but it's 50 people who had been exposed. And I haven't heard, you know, what the outcome of those tests were. But, I mean, if that was in one day. So I think we're in for a pretty bad tear on this.
What does that mean? Number one, why are the numbers that we're getting from the state of Texas not reflecting that? And then what does it mean that if we have cases in the hundreds?
Well, first of all, you know, they're, what you're getting from the state of Texas are absolutely confirmed cases. So the test, you know, they run the test. You know how this goes. They run the test and it takes a day or two to get it back. So the state of Texas is lagging behind because just the process. I mean, that's not a criticism. I can criticize the state of Texas, but not for that. And then the reason we're saying it could be in the hundreds just because, you know, somebody, as I understand the measles, when someone gets the measles, they may have been exposed and it may be 4 or 5 days before they actually exhibit the symptoms. In that 4 or 5 days, all the people they've come in contact with are now exposed.
We got new numbers this morning, Friday morning, 90 cases. Mm-hmm. Last time they released new numbers on Tuesdays and Friday.
That's right.
Should they be releasing them more frequently? Would that be helpful?
We think it would be, sure. I'm not clear on why they're only doing Tuesday and Friday, other than I do believe that the state health department is understaffed. They have had some slowdown in communication because of the CDC slowdown in communication.
The hub of the outbreak, it started in Gaines County, which is a low population county, but they had a 17.62% exemption rate for students going into their public school system for vaccines.
Yes.
That seemed to have given this the foothold for the measles to take hold, and now it's spreading elsewhere. And we're seeing a lot of infants getting it who were too young to be vaccinated. There are some questions about whether or not Texas has made it too easy for people to get exemptions. And right now in the legislature, there are more than 20 bills that have been filed that would make it even easier to opt out of getting a vaccination. What do you make of that?
You're absolutely right. The state of Texas has made it incredibly easy for a parent to opt out their child from the required vaccines to go to school. Lots of states have non-medical exemption policies. Some are very strict and, you know, precise about it. You have to really have the right reasons and explain them, et cetera. There's several states where just to get the exemption, the parent has to take some sort of public education to get it. The fact that in Texas, all you have to do is go to the state health department website, request a form and you complete them, you have them notarized, and you turn them into the school. No question. It's really, I call it the no explanation needed exemption, though it's called an exemption for philosophical conscience and religious reasons. They are talking about making it even easier. They are talking about making it a downloadable form. There are bills that would require school nurses to have the forms at the ready when the parents come to register their children for school. Every parent who forgot to get their kid vaccinated, I mean, it becomes something other than an objection for philosophical, religious, or conscience reasons. It becomes a matter of convenience.
The outbreak we have in West Texas is right on the border with New Mexico.
Yep.
New Mexico does not make it so easy to opt out to get the exemption for vaccinations. So we're seeing in real time the difference in what happens when you have an outbreak of measles in a state like Texas and a state like New Mexico. New Mexico has reported of 9 cases, and Texas has a case of 90 cases. So
That's
you can just figure out what works and what doesn't work.
That's right. If you go on the New Mexico State Health Department website, you will see that they list every day the places where there may have been exposures to measles. It says Walmart, McDonald's, whatever. Nobody's doing that in Texas. They're not telling us where the exposures were. And then you think about your point about the 90 versus 9, then there were a heck of a lot of exposures in Hobbs, and yet we only had 9 cases. So you're right. The less liberal, shall we say, non-medical exemption policy is proving its worth in New Mexico.
Terry Burke is the executive director of the Texas-based Immunization Partnership. Since Texas has banned abortion, there has been plenty of evidence that this is leading to additional deaths and major health risk for pregnant women and infants. However, much of that evidence is not coming from the state of Texas because investigations into maternal mortality have been put on hold, and the state is not sharing pregnancy death data the way it used to do before the overturning of Roe. But the nonprofit investigative journalism newsroom ProPublica has obtained the data and is for the first time unveiling just how bad things are in Texas. According to ProPublica, dozens more pregnant and postpartum women have died in Texas hospitals since SB 8 and then the post-Dobbs ban were put in place. ProPublica has also found that the number of women suffering from sepsis shot up more than 50% since the abortion bans were put in place. Lizzie Presser is a lead reporter on the ProPublica team that produced Texas Banned Abortion, Then Sepsis Rates Soared.
So we started off reporting on preventable deaths and looking at the cases of women who are dying in Texas after they experience pregnancy complications and then delays in care. That before SB 8 were delays that they wouldn't necessarily have faced, right? We couldn't get into the doctor's heads, but we could see the behavior in their medical charts and from their surviving family members. And we would document their cases in an anecdotal way to try to understand better what was going on for women experiencing miscarriage in Texas. And then we thought, you know, this is one way of looking at the problem, but what if we actually purchased hospital data from the state and took a macro view to understand the broader trends across the state? What if this is just a few hospitals and we're getting it wrong? And so we bought that data and we took a long time, but we developed a methodology to analyze that data. And what we found is that when you look at women who are experiencing the end of a pregnancy in all Texas hospitals after SB 8, they are 50% more likely to get sepsis now than they were before the ban was put in place. That's an enormous spike in the rates of sepsis for these hospitalizations. And sepsis, we were hearing from many obstetricians and health researchers, is a really clear indicator of exactly what we were finding in our anecdotal stories, delays in care. And it is the body's intense reaction to infection. It is life-threatening. It should not be spiking.
I mean, tell me more about sepsis. How does it come about? I mean, I hear it when I watch Call the Midwife, but, you know, what is it?
It's a really good question. It is basically an inflammatory response in your body to an infection that has gone untreated. And what you see in some of these cases with women who are experiencing some kind of pregnancy complication in the second trimester is that that infection can get to their uterus. And the best way to treat an infection in the uterus is to empty the uterus. But sometimes that means terminating a pregnancy, as long as there is a heartbeat. Even if we are talking about a pre-viable pregnancy, right? A woman who certainly will not be able to deliver a fetus that will survive outside the womb. For a doctor to empty the uterus, they could, under Texas law, be charged with providing an abortion and face up to 99 years in prison.
So to capsulize this, before the abortion ban, doctors were willing, less restricted, and being able to provide treatment that would avoid sepsis taking hold, and now they can't. And so we're seeing more cases of sepsis, and we're also seeing more fatalities.
That's right. And we could even go one step further, which is that before SB8, doctors would follow what is standard of care, what the guidelines that are put out by their medical societies, by ACOG, by the Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine, which say that if a woman comes in experiencing a second trimester miscarriage before fetal viability, that doctors are advised to provide the option of terminating the pregnancy even before they can locate an infection. And what we are seeing in Texas is that because of the way the law is written, there are doctors and, we should be clear, hospital policies that are requiring doctors to be able to document a life-threatening condition before they can intervene in a pregnancy where there is still a heartbeat. What we saw when we looked very closely at particular cases is just how risky it is to wait for a quote-unquote life-threatening emergency. We wrote about Nevaeh Crane, an 18-year-old who had sepsis. By the time they could confirm fetal demise, it had developed so far along that she had another complication called DIC, disseminated intravascular coagulation, which basically meant massive internal bleeding in her case, and they could no longer operate. And she died still pregnant, in fact, in her 24th week.
Organizations like the Texas Alliance for Life are pushing back on the type of reporting that you're doing. They're saying that since Dobbs went into effect, that 135 abortions have been performed in Texas to save women's lives. That they say, reporting that the abortion ban is making women's lives more deadly, more dangerous, is just not true. That the laws that are in place right now to protect the lives of the mother, they say these laws work, and that this is evidence that it is working, that on average we have 3 to 4 abortions performed per month in the state of Texas in order to preserve the lives of the mother. What's your reaction to that?
One of the things we wrote about in this piece is that number that they are giving us, 135 in the state of Texas, if you actually dig into that data, almost all of those abortions, I think all but 5 of those abortions, are performed in an emergency situation. And again, this comes back to what we're describing here. You are waiting for women who are pregnant and miscarrying, who are not going to give birth to a live baby. You are waiting for those women to reach an emergency status, like sepsis, which is a life-threatening infection. Why are we asking doctors to let their patients wait for women to become septic when they can intervene before they become septic? I think that's the question that many of the physicians and the health researchers who reviewed our findings were asking. What they were seeing in the stark figures that we presented was that doctors are not intervening to stave off potentially life-threatening complications, because they need to wait for an emergency.
Do we know, what are the demographics of the women who are dying from sepsis? Of course, we've seen high-profile cases in Texas, like Katie Cox and others, may not fit into that demographic of women of color. But looking at the numbers, I mean, who are these women who are able to access these legal abortions in Texas to, you know, save their lives? And who are the ones who are not?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're asking two really important questions here. And one is, I'll just start with, which is that we will know very little without the Maternal Mortality Review Committee looking at the deaths data from 2022 and 2023. And that's what the Maternal Mortality Review Committee in Texas has said. They are skipping those years and moving to 2024. We found in our analysis that we could spot 120 women who died in hospital in those years while they were pregnant or 6 weeks postpartum experiencing a complication. Those are just in-hospital deaths, and those are deaths that we have no further information about without a review of their medical records. So there's a lot of information we don't have. We as ProPublica are trying to fill in the gaps where we can. Demographically in Texas, we haven't done an analysis on deaths and the demographics, but we know nationally from data that what you will see over and over again is that women with means are able to leave a state with an abortion ban and get the care that they need. Those who are less socioeconomically advantaged are going to be the ones who are pushed into suffering their pregnancy complications at home, where they cannot necessarily get the care that they need to prevent life-threatening complications or, in the worst-case scenario, death.
The state of Texas, you know, the lawmakers in Austin right now in the current legislative session, there are some grumblings that they may need to massage the law, tweak it a bit in order to prevent these terrible outcomes without admitting that these terrible outcomes are real. And we've heard from, as in your reporting, you write about Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick saying that he thinks it's time to make some changes. Some lawmakers agree with that. In your reporting, you have Governor Greg Abbott seeing like that he's open to it, but Greg Abbott also told the Houston Chronicle 2 days ago that he didn't think the law need to be changed. So where do you think we're going here?
It's really hard to know where we're going here. And that's going to be up to the lawmakers in the state of Texas to figure out what they believe needs to be done to protect women and to protect their health and their lives. We can't see into the future. What we can see is that we have found and written about 3 women in Texas who died unnecessarily after these abortion bans were put in place, where they were not able to access care that before SB 8 they should have been able to access. And what we can now see from this data is that this is not isolated, that there is a statewide trend that shows delays in care for women who are experiencing miscarriage. These aren't elective abortions. These are women who are experiencing pregnancy loss and who need help from their physicians and aren't able to get it. If that doesn't move the needle, I don't know what does.
Well, in your reporting, you have dozens more pregnant and postpartum women died in Texas hospitals since the abortion ban went into effect. This is while the national mortality rate fell, it rose in Texas by 33%. That is a massive red flag.
It looks that way to me too. I mean, we can't, again, like one of the things about death data that we have to be really careful about is that it requires deeper investigation, and the state is not even doing those investigations for these 2 years. So we can't tell for certain what happened in these cases. We can see that there was a sharp rise in maternal mortality in Texas, whereas the national rate was falling.
A cynic would say that there is a statewide cover-up going on right now, and the state of Texas now is no longer going to be sharing its maternal mortality data with the national database. So there does seem to be a less openness in Texas about what is happening here.
That's why we're doing this work. We're trying to get our hands on as much data as we can to understand what is happening in the state of Texas when the state of Texas doesn't want to give that information to its own residents.
The women who go through this process, who end up with sepsis, families that lose a loved one who had a pregnancy and then they died, are they aware this didn't have to happen? Are they being informed that your loved one didn't have to go through this experience, painful experience, if they survived, but this has only happened because of this abortion ban, which made being pregnant in Texas more dangerous?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I've spoken to many women and their families who didn't understand what was happening as it was happening, and only after they experienced a medical emergency or after after Hope Gumezi lost his wife, Portia Gumezi, did he understand, oh, this might actually have to do with the law that I didn't think would ever affect my wife, who wanted desperately to have this child that she was pregnant with? So I've heard mixed reactions. I mean, I spoke to one woman who was literally sitting in the hospital. She was miscarrying, but there was still a heartbeat. It was in her second trimester, and she was watching TV, and she was watching people on the screen protesting for reproductive rights as she was lying in a hospital bed, losing amniotic fluid. It's dripping on her legs, she's saying to me, and her doctor is saying, the hospital will not let me touch you. We are going to have to wait until you get septic. I mean, it is a horrifying reality for the people who are living through it to understand that they cannot get the help that they desperately need. And they know they need help. So it's this moment of realizing, wait, I can't get help because of a law that in theory is supposed to be about elective abortion, but is now actually preventing me, someone who didn't ever think I would fall into a category of women affected by this, from getting care that could save my life, right? That's the story I keep hearing over and over again from women.
But you were able to find the data. You bought the data. What does that mean?
It's expensive data to buy, but we did buy the data. It is available from the Department of Health, and you know, we were lucky enough to be able to get it and to be able to look into it at a quick enough pace. Academic paces are much longer. So it means that there is information out there. It just requires a certain level of resources and expertise to dig into some of the numbers and figure out what the trends are in the state. And we have a lot more digging to do with the data we already have.
Right. So you did data journalism and have gone through the training and all that, and they tell you to torture your data, like look for things that may go wrong. That you, if you have numbers like that are like these that are jumping off the screen, that you know you uncovered that the rate of sepsis for women who lost second trimester pregnancies in the hospital increased by 55% since the state's first abortion ban SB8 went into effect. I mean, that sounds like, oh my God, this is wrong. How do we figure this out? And so you took this. How did you make sure this was right? I mean, who did you talk to?
That's a really good question, dude. This was months of reporting, and we spoke to dozens of obstetricians and maternal health researchers, epidemiologists, demographers, to figure out how best to analyze our data. And by that, I mean, I'm not the data journalist. My colleague, Andrea Suozo, is the mastermind behind the numbers. But we were on these calls together trying to understand, okay, what is the right code to use to crunch these numbers? How do we filter them appropriately? Well, part of what was interesting is that there really hasn't been an established methodology to study pregnancy loss and accompanying complications in this country. We tend to look at maternal morbidity at the point of birth, not at the point of pregnancy loss. And so we tried to do something quite different with the help of, again, dozens of experts in this field who were guiding us along the way and who were reading our methodology as we were building it. And alongside our story, we published a pretty dense methodology for anyone who is interested in understanding a little bit better kind of how we did the analysis that we did. And for anyone who wants to try to apply that methodology to their own state or to other data elsewhere.
And when you took this, your findings to doctors, OBGYNs in Texas, what did they tell you?
You know, I can't say that people were surprised by the findings, but what I can say is they were kind of stunned by how clear the trend lines were. This is something that doctors in Texas have been warning of since before SB8 passed, that if you make these laws, if you make abortion a crime, you're going to make it a lot more dangerous to be pregnant in the state of Texas. And that's what these charts show you. I think one thing everyone was really interested to see is that the rate of sepsis before SB8 was quite steady. It hovered around 3% for many years. And then right after 2021, we looked at kind of the 9 quarters after SB8 compared to the 9 quarters before SB8. You start to see that trend line really tick up, and it keeps going up in 2022 and 2023 as well. So I think what people were saying was this is a really clear signal in the data, and it's not just a hypothesis. This is important evidence in a growing body of work that is indicating that these laws are dangerous for pregnant women.
Well, the reason why it's dangerous for pregnant women is because doctors are afraid to treat them because of the law as it's been presented, and where they could face huge fines, life in prison, loss of their medical license. But groups like Texas Alliance for Life, quoting them again, they're saying, well, no doctor has been charged. That hasn't happened to anyone since this law went into effect. So why are they so afraid? And then when you in your reporting, you talk to or you try to reach these politicians like Greg Abbott and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and others, and they're saying, yeah, we're willing to work with you on this. Maybe they signaled that a little bit. But you didn't get a comment back from the Attorney General Ken Paxton. Now, Paxton has been the one who has been the most hard-line publicly and also legally doing everything he can in order to enforce the letter of the law or even beyond the letter of law. And I think he's the reason why doctors are so afraid. I mean, no one is going to reassess their view on how harsh this could be or what they can do until there's a signal from Ken Paxton that he is willing to work with them on that.
I think that's right. I mean, one thing I will just add to what you're saying is that this is not just doctors who are afraid. These are hospitals that have policies. And one of the things that we've been trying to do, and I will say it is difficult, is to understand better what the hospital policies are from place to place, because we believe that it's important to be transparent. If you have a loved one who lives in Texas, you want to be able to say, hey, go to this hospital instead of that hospital, because over here, you're going to get care that this other hospital isn't going to give you necessarily, right? And there is great variation we are finding. So in some parts of the country, hospitals are totally okay to intervene in something called premature rupture of membranes or previable premature rupture of membranes. The legal team has said to their doctors, go ahead. We feel like we can protect you if you are prosecuted in this case. And in other hospitals, the legal team is saying, sorry, we don't feel comfortable. So this is another area, or it's another kind of pressure point in this landscape. How can hospitals start to be more open about how they are handling these cases, what they are asking of the physicians who work in their buildings, and whether or not they are willing to take a risk and say, yeah, we will defend you if you are prosecuted.
Yeah, but those risks, if you lose, the penalties are huge.
That's exactly right. And so even though we haven't seen anyone who's been prosecuted as a physician for performing an abortion in Texas, the laws are no joke. I mean, you risk up to 99 years in prison. And not only that, but you become a poster child. I hear this from a lot of doctors, that no doctor wants to be that poster child. No doctor wants to hire the lawyer, go to the courtroom, make a defense, pay all your own legal fees, and risk up to 99 years in prison. How can you ask a doctor to go out on a limb for a patient if that's the potential consequence?
Lizzie Presser is a lead reporter on the ProPublica team that produced Texas Banned Abortion, Then Sepsis Rates Soared. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters programs on our website at tpr.org, and you can download and subscribe to us wherever you find cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.